Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. This week we're going to be talking about the fifth Star Trek film, The Final Frontier, which was released in 1989. First, some brief feedback. Just want to do a shout out to some people who responded to my Conan the Barbarian podcast. Scott Merrihew and Matt Hurt liked it on Twitter. HedgeKnight84 retweeted me. On Facebook, Corey Wayman chimed in with the crush your enemies speech. So thanks, Corey. And thanks everyone who reached out. So let's jump into a little background on Star Trek V. During the original run of the TV series, Shatner and Nimoy's lawyers drafted what Shatner termed a, quote, favored nations clause, with the result that kind of whatever Shatner received, for example, a pay raise or script control, Nimoy also got, and vice versa, since they were the two stars of the show. So Nimoy directed Star Trek III and Star Trek IV. Shatner had previously only directed plays and TV episodes, but so he kind of held out on the voyage home because I think Nimoy was making way more as a director slash star. So at that point, I think they promised that Shatner could direct the next one. Shatner conceived of the idea for the story before he was given the job to direct. He says his inspiration was televangelists. Quote, they were repulsive, strangely horrifying, and yet I became absolutely fascinated, end quote. He's intrigued that not only did these personalities convince others that God was speaking directly to them, but they became wealthy by what Shatner considered false messages. So the televangelists formed the basis for a character named Zar, which later became Cybok. Shatner's first outline was entitled An Act of Love, and a lot of the elements in that made it to the final film. In an early draft, Kirk is overwhelmed by Zar's superior numbers of followers, and Spock, McCoy, and the rest of the Enterprise crew come to believe in Zar's divinity, betraying Kirk. Kirk feigns acceptance of Zar's beliefs to travel with him to God's planet, which to Shatner would be a desolate, fiery waste. When Kirk confronts God, the image of the being transforms into that of Satan, and Kirk, Spock, and McCoy split up in their escape. Kirk eludes capture, but goes back to save his friends from being carried away to hell. So, bonkers first idea. Shatner presents it to the studio head, a guy by the name of Frank Mancuso. Mancuso liked the idea, and they agreed to hire a writer to draft, a treatment. Shatner wanted novelist Eric Van Lustbader, but the negotiations broke down. Lustbader wanted $1 million, and they weren't going to give it to him. So Shatner dictated the story himself and gave it to Paramount. Harv Bennett had been on board since Star Trek II and wanted to move on. He felt that he wasn't part of the Star Trek family and that Nimoy had kind of mistreated him, on the last two films. But Shatner tried to convince Bennett to reconsider. After a long discussion, Bennett agreed to return as producer. First off, Bennett disagreed with a lot of elements of Shatner's story, feeling that no one could assuredly answer the question of God's existence. The ending of the film would never be satisfying. So Bennett also told Shatner that the film had the feeling of a tone poem rather than an adventure story. The studio backed Bennett, reasoning that the subject matter might be too weighty or offensive to a lot of different filmgoers. They started reworking the story, concerned that knowing Cybok's motivation from the beginning of the story was anticlimactic. They kind of moved the revelation to later. Shatner said that Bennett suggested turning the God entity into an evil alien pretending to be God for his own gain. Paramount was happy with the changes. They went after Nick Meyer to actually write a new script, but he was unavailable. And then Bennett found some guy named David Lowery, who penned the final script. So not everyone was happy with the story. Roddenberry hated it. And it's interesting, one of Roddenberry's employees said that his animosity might be based on the fact that, you know, his original idea for Star Trek the motion picture was sort of the God thing, which dealt with similar ideas, but Paramount had rejected. At some point, Roddenberry, Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly all disagreed that Spock and McCoy would ever betray Kirk. You know, they wanted to give it more conflict, but they made changes based on that, that, you know, they would never, those, you can't split up that three. And they were, I think they were correct. So then the Writers Guild of America went on strike, putting a halt to everything. The writing stopped, and Nimoy went off to work on another project because everything was stalled. Shatner was now reconsidering story elements. He changed Sybak's character to be more sympathetic. When Shatner had gone away to do a job and Lowry had returned and continued to do revisions, Shatner returned and found that the search for mythical paradise, not God, it was more Eden. The term Shakari was a word play on Sean Connery, who was originally contacted to be Sybok. So Shatner lobbied against Shakari and Eden versus God, and it ended up obviously not being a search for God, but a search for Eden. And there was supposed to be like rock monsters that came to life at the end that chased our heroes across the landscape, and they just ran out of money. And they were going to have one rock monster. They did a test, and it looked terrible. So the rock monster became the big floating head that shot lightning instead. So all right, so let's jump in. Things start actually pretty well in Star Trek V visually. There's this opening on Nimbus 3, and it's beautifully shot, like this beautiful widescreen shot, lots of depth of field. It looks really good. You know, it looks kind of like very realistic for a Star Trek film. There's some strange character digging holes in the desert where smoke is coming out. There's the approach of this horseman, and it's very impressionistic. You know, like the horseman is closing slowly, and there's some sound effects going on, and it's kind of haunting in a way. So kind of interesting opening. And here we see the first instance of Sybok's power, played by this guy Lawrence Luckinbill, who's just dynamite. Really, really solid actor. He must have been like, what am I doing in this movie? But he's really good. And we get a reveal that he has some kind of power about others sharing pain with him. They gain strength from the sharing, and it kind of relieves them of this psychic emotional pain. The reveal is that he's a Vulcan and that he's laughing. And I like here that the villain, for a change, is a seeker after knowledge. Rather than the usual, you know, there's a Klingon bad guy in this film as usual, right? But the main antagonist here is a guy who's seeking after ultimate knowledge and not like a scenery chewer, which I think was a nice change of pace, you know, for a change. I mean, obviously 4 was kind of similar. They were just fighting against time and to get the whales back, you know. And I think it is cool once in a while when there's an out-and-out villain, but Trek is not as simplistic as Star Wars, in a sense that, you know, it's this good versus evil. Like, Trek is more complex, so I like when the villain's more complex. So, though, the one thing I did notice is that we're back using the Next Generation opening, which we haven't heard since the first movie. 2, 3, and 4 were a different theme, and now we're back to the Next Gen theme, which I think goes away in 6, but so kind of confusing because I think Next Gen was on at this point. The next shot we cut to a cantina on Nimbus 3, which, you know, you can't do a cantina without it being a Star Wars rip in a way. But not very adventurous. The sci-fi aspect of some of the things, there's a pool table and they're playing pool and there's water in it, you know, and I just imagine some guy saying like, well, what would be a cool like sci-fi? Hey, what if we just put water on the pool table? We don't really have to do much, you know. Very cheesy makeup and aliens. They didn't really spend a lot of money on it. One thing I noticed, though, is that there was this cat creature, which winds up attacking Kirk later on, but she has 3 breasts. And I believe this film predates Total Recall by at least a year. So it's possible that the 3-breasted woman was really a Star Trek V creation and not Total Recall. So I have to read further on that, but I was kind of surprised. I was like, hey, wouldn't be surprised if Total Recall ripped from this, but you never know. They could have been filming concurrently. So we meet what's called the 3 representatives on the planet for galactic peace, Federation, Romulan, and Klingon. David Warner is the Federation representative, really great actor and kind of a nothing role. And so then we witness Sybok's attack. I guess he had come up with this ragtag army with makeshift weapons, and he attacks this cantina where these 3 are sitting. It's kind of a Road Warrior rip, you know, the way it looks as it goes on. And Sybok arrives and wants them to call to their respective governments for help because he wants a starship. Then we have our Yosemite opening back on Earth. The various people are out on shore leave. We join Captain Kirk as he is climbing El Capitan in Yosemite National Park. Nice intro, actually. The credits are continuing here, and these beautiful shots of Yosemite. The climbing shots are great, real odd Dutch angles and kind of lens flares. Every once in a while, like Shatner, I have to say, as much as this movie is kind of a turd, Shatner has a better eye, or Shatner had a better DP than Nimoy did. You know, you never know. But some of the shots in 5 in the beginning, like they show an eye, like someone's got an eye. Whereas, you know, most of the of 3 and 4, very utilitarian directing. It's more about timing and editing and character. But this one, there's some, you know, every once in a while, there's a visual moment where you're like, hey, someone's thinking about, you know, how things look. So it's kind of cool. Basically, this whole thing is played for comedy. Bones is on the ground cursing, just complaining that he was brought along on this camping vacation. We have the introduction of Spock in these rocket boots, which will come into play later on. It's all very goofy. Spock distracts Kirk. He slips and falls. Scott, you know, Spock saves him, and he's like, hi, Bones. Mind if we drop by? You know, very, very campy. The most campy we've seen so far. Like, you know, there is always in humor in Trek. But this is the first film where it really kind of edges into camp. So we have the bourbon with beans and the discussion, and then all of a sudden it gets very dour, and they're setting up the end scene of the film. Kirk saying, I knew I wouldn't die because I wasn't alone. I've always known I'll die alone. I guess in Generations, you know, he doesn't die alone, but he dies without those two. So you could say it's canon. And then they start this theme about other people have families. Bones is sort of talking about, look at us. We spent all this time together on ship, and when it comes to shore leave, what do? We take it together. And I kind of like that, you know, like there's a line where Bones says, other people have families. Kirk says, other people, Bones, not us. They're dealing straight with the fact that, you know, time is passing, but they've become almost, you know, they are a family of friends together. Kind of like that, you know. There is a generally good moment of Spock has studied manuals on camping out and produces a marshmallow from a, you know, a replicator machine. And they begin to sing. And, you know, as a Trek fan, it's good, right? I mean, it's fun. The three of them kind of goofing around. So then we cut to Scotty on the Enterprise, and we see the Enterprise is a total mess. It's a brand new one. You know, it's just been refit. They're just getting out the bugs. There's this weird byplay between Uhura and Scotty in this scene, and then later on, after Uhura's been sort of dealt with by Cybok, where there's like a little action going on. Scotty's like, oh, you Lassie, you're the most understanding woman. You feel like they're hanging together or they're being pushed together, and I don't know. They never made much more of that in the later films, so from what I remember. So that was kind of interesting. The distress call then from Nimbus 3 comes through on the Enterprise bridge then. So then, you know, the crew has to be recalled. We get a brief scene of Chekhov and Sulu hiking, and they're lost. And the funny moment when Chekhov's kind of faking they're in a windstorm, and Uhura tells them that it's clear skies, and kind of cute. You know, it's good. It's good Trek back and forth. It's fun. Then enters the Klingon bad guy, by the name of Kla, who destroys something that looks like Voyager, but it's actually I did a little research, it's the Pioneer 10 space probe, launched in March 1972, and became the first space probe to pass by and photograph Jupiter, and currently is heading towards the star of Aldebaran, which it should reach in about, 2 million years or so. So he's basically out cruising the galaxy looking for a fight, he's a renegade, he blows up the Pioneer, and then they get the distress call from the Klingon representative, make a beeline for Nimbus 3. So then we have kind of a fun moment where they're on the Enterprise and they're dealing with all the problems. And there's a great moment where Scotty doesn't have the ship ready and he's going off yelling at someone. And McCoy's like, I don't think I've ever seen him happier. It's a great moment. The doors don't open all the way. His new yeoman is actually Shatner's daughter, Melanie Shatner, who gets him to sign certain things. And then there's a fun moment where he sits in his chair and he kind of looks at it. And Bones is like, what's wrong, Jim? And he's like, I miss my old chair. He tries to do a captain's log and the machine doesn't work. You know, up till now, like, you know, we're kind of having a good time. You know, it's a little more campy than we're used to, but there's some good, you know, there's some good comedy between the principals here. So it's not off the charts yet. Then they're reviewing the distress call from Nimbus 3, and Spock takes a photo of Cybok sort of on his own science station and looks at it. We get the sense that he may know this person, but we cut away. And then the next scene, Spock is in, which looks like kind of a 10 forward, some kind of lounge. It's got a ship's wheel in it and you know, a compass. Yeah, there's a big portal to space. Bones and Kirk sort of confront him, and we get the initial connection. Cybok reminds him of someone he used to know in his youth, a Vulcan who rejected the logic and embraced his animal ancestors and his emotions. You know, we're getting the information that for Cybok, the key to self-knowledge lie in the emotions, not logic. So he was banished from Vulcan. So check, we've got the villain's backstory. Then the tension steps up a little bit. The clock is ticking. A Klingon bird of prey has just entered the system. It's going to be there in an hour. The transporters are not working yet because Scotty hasn't fixed them. And I think it's always good when the transporters aren't working. I mean, the transporters always go out a lot anyway because they're kind of like a magical device. If you had working transporters in every episode continuously, I think you wouldn't have any drama, you know? But they have to take the shuttle. They do this gambit where, you know, Chekhov's going to act as the captain and Kirk and Spock and the crew are going to go down and then figure out a way to storm the compound, get the hostages back. What I'm told is the crew that goes with Kirk and Spock and McCoy are the Federation Marines, which I believe hadn't been seen yet. So, but now the whole thing goes off the rails. The Uhura fan dance. And immediately makes the film kind of a joke. Now we're kind of in like Star Trek V, the comedy Enterprise, because you have the fan dance and her singing. And then, of course, Shatner, right? He owns a horse farm. So he's always trying to get horses in the mix of things. Uhura distracts the men guarding the horses with her fan dance. They're taken captive. And then the rest of them and the Marines take the horses and they ride in. You know, it's like a Western now. They're riding into the main city of Nimbus 3. There's a goofy line, you know, hold your horse, Captain, when they get there. That Spock says to Kirk. Anyway, there's some kind of fist fighting here, a few blaster shots. It's a very kind of low budget sci-fi battle. There's another really goofy moment when Spock nerve pinches a horse, which is, again, another moment where you're like, okay, we're in a whole other kind of movie here. Then there's a scene where Kirk's fighting the three-breasted cat alien, which is kind of goofy, but he kills the alien. He throws the alien in the pool table. And from what I can tell, it's dead. You know, like its head is submerged underwater and it's passed out. And I thought it was a very casual Kirk killing aliens. Like I never got that. And it, to me, again, it's another thing. Immediately, the fan dance, hold your horse, Captain, the nerve pinch of the horse, Kirk killing an alien indiscriminately. Just all of a sudden, I'm like, I don't know what kind of movie I'm in. I don't know who wrote this thing, but I don't know if they've ever watched an episode of Star Trek. So we get the reveal now that the three, quote, hostages are actually in league with Cybok, that he's kind of transformed them with his powers. Spock and Cybok meet, and Cybok's telling him, I found it, the thing that I've been searching for. We don't know what that is yet. There's a nice moment where Cybok says, Spock, what do you have to say for yourself? You haven't seen me in so many years. You know, that you're under arrest for violations of the Neutral Zone Treaty. And Cybok laughs and says, Spock, you've developed a sense of humor after all, that's a good line. Then, at this point, we're getting back into Trek a little bit. The Klingons are on, they're cloaking. So they're all on the shuttle, Cybok and Kirk and Spock, McCoy and Uhura. They're all on the shuttle heading back to the Enterprise. Kirk has to convince Cybok to let him take control of the shuttle. And he does this fake out, you know, where he says over an open channel, emergency landing plan B. It's kind of funny. You know, they do this thing where they drop the shields briefly and they zoom into the landing bay. And it's cool to see Chekhov getting some nice work for a change. Warp speeds now. He's the bluffer and he has a moment where he's in command of the ship. So rare to see Chekhov have like real scenes, you know. And Sulu gets a few, you know, he's piloting the shuttle, so he gets a few moments and stuff. After the crash, everyone on the shuttle's passed out, but Cybok comes to first, and he's walking Kirk off the shuttle when they start scrabbling for the gun. It gets thrown. There's a funny line where you see Kirk say, pick it up, and Spock picks up the weapon, holds it on Cybok, and basically Cybok's like, you're going to have to kill me. And it's not a phaser, so it looks like a very strange-looking kind of regular weapon that would probably kill him. Cybok basically walks right into the muzzle and says, well, you're going to have to kill me, and Spock doesn't. So he, Kirk, and McCoy are taken to the brig, and then we see Cybok do the pain-sharing thing with Sulu and Uhura because they're needed to sort of operate the ship. Then when they're in the brig, Cybok announces the whole ship, the MacGuffin in the film, the whole quest for Shakari or Eden, where all the creation sprang from, so on and so forth. They're going to go past this great barrier, which blocks, I guess, ships from going to the center of the galaxy. You know, as a thematic concept, it's clever in that it is, you know, and even Cybok says this, that the great barrier is a physical manifestation of man's fears, and if fear, being able to walk through fear in order to get to sort of a connection with the higher power or God. I like that. You know, like there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's a really cool idea. It's not done justice by the film itself, but it's kind of a cool idea that the great barrier that exists is a manifestation of all sentient beings' fears. All sentient beings in the galaxy are kind of similar in that we fear, you know, what we don't understand, and we fear pain, and it blocks us from getting in touch with deeper things that may exist on the other side of it. So pretty cool, you know, but not in this movie, you know. So then we're in the brig, and we get some really goofy dialogue. It's edited in times like a kind of a sitcom. We find out that Cybok is Spock's half-brother, also a son of Sarek. And it's funny, you know, there are certain lines that Kirk's like fed up with Spock, and he's yelling at him, and then he's shaking his head. You know, I'm laughing, right? I mean, but it's goofy. It's really goofy. Scotty jailbreaks them, has a great line. Don't you know a jailbreak when you see one? So he breaks them out, and then there's this goofy sequence where, first of all, they split up, and Scotty's going to meet them somewhere. There's a kind of a funny moment when he turns around and he says, I know this ship like the back of my, and he bangs his head into a bulkhead and passes out. So Kirk, Spock, and McCoy are climbing up some shaft halfway up. Spock arrives with gravity boots, and he tries to carry them. Of course, they're too heavy, and this is just this goofy back and forth with the gravity boots. It's whatever. But then we get to the part, the only part of the film that I really like is the scene where Kirk, Spock, and McCoy are in the sort of 10-forward area, and Cybok comes in. Cybok works his power on Spock and McCoy. The McCoy scene is great, man. You know, we find out that this is what Cybok does. He can intuit psychologically what your greatest fear is or your greatest pain is, and you relive it. But with him there, with you, so he's sharing it with you, and you kind of can go through it and cathartically dispel a lot of it, which is great. I mean, you know, it's a great psychological kind of truism that does occur. I tell you, this is DeForest Kelly's like finest moment. It's a beautiful scene with his dad on his deathbed. They really play this out. They really give DeForest Kelly a nice chunk of acting here, and he nails it. You know, he's very good where, you know, his father was in so much pain, dying from an ailment that they didn't have a cure for. And so Bones basically does a Kevorkian on him and sort of sends him on his way. You know, the pain that McCoy is holding is that 3 or 4 months later, a cure was developed for the very disease that his father had. And if McCoy wouldn't have pushed the button, it would have cured him and he would have lived, you know, however many more years. But there's a beautiful moment when Cybok walks up next to McCoy and he's like, what have you done? And McCoy is like, I preserved his dignity. Like, it's a beautiful scene. Like, it's the best scene in the whole movie, you know? Really, like, solid drama. It's really impressive. And then we have Spock's moment in Cybok's thrall where, you know, he's reliving his birth when he was, you know, so human. And the cool thing is it doesn't work on Spock because Cybok doesn't really know Spock. And Spock's already kind of faced his life's greatest pain and greatest fear, and he's found himself. And it's a nice speech by Nimoy. He's like, I know who I am, and I know that I can't go with you. I tell you, what I think about here is they missed a hell of an opportunity to do the same thing with Kirk. You know, because we don't really know. I mean, think about, we know Kirk's a hero, and, you know, he's a great character, and we love Kirk. But we don't really know what makes Kirk tick, really. Like, you know, there's some regrets of lost love, and he doesn't really have a family. Some stuff with his brother. But, you know, we know Spock. We know Spock a lot. We know that the half-human, half-Vulcan stuff. We know about Vulcan culture. So Spock's a very complex character, and we know what makes him tick. He's always at war with the human versus the Vulcan side of him. It makes him very complicated, and it always plays into the stories. And McCoy, you know, the irascible doctor, we don't know really much about McCoy either, but in this film, the thing about his father really plays into what we do know about McCoy. It makes him a deeper character. And I thought, boy, they missed the boat because I would have loved to dive in to Kirk. You know, what was Kirk's greatest fear? And I guess that with Generations, we do get it. And that his greatest pain and greatest regret is not, you know, not being able to have a family and get married and have children and so on and so forth. But, you know, they play it where Kirk's explanation is like, I need my pain. You know, you can't take away pain with the magic wand. I need it. But anyway, it doesn't happen. And I feel like this terrific sequence is in this just crap hole of a film. It's such a good, deep, dramatic sequence. It doesn't have anything to do really with the plot. I mean, a little bit it does, right? They're facing their pain, so they're getting in touch with this sort of godlike maybe energy, which unites them with Cyborg. But it's not really played up, especially not at the end. I mean, the end should have been thematically unified to deal with this stuff. But the end is just like a big head chasing our guys. It's pretty terrible. But anyway, I feel like this kernel of the sequence here was like what could have been or what might have been had they really kind of thrown away maybe the action event. I don't know. I don't even know what I'm talking about. But there's something here that was interesting and the thematic idea of the Great Barrier and them being a family. But I feel like it's completely squandered by the movie. So now we have the passage of the Great Barrier, which is not interesting at all. It's some, you know, cheesy special effects that even in 1989 we'd seen everywhere else. The suspense is decent, right? I mean, at this moment now, they get through the barrier and there's the planet. So they milk it a little bit because now we're like, we're waiting to meet God, basically, right? So they milk it with these long sequences of shots. They're cutting back and forth between Cyborg, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, like, you know, traversing parts of the desert, very exciting. And then people, you know, on the bridge looking, you know, with wonder on the view screen. And they take like, you know, almost like 2 minutes to get them there because they're just milking. This is the only suspense now that we really have. And then we get the emergence of sort of what I like to call Godhenge. The lights go out, you know, this kind of Stonehenge-like thing appears out of nowhere. Then we have this confrontation with this creature that's supposed to be God, and immediately it's not because it zaps Kirk when he questions it, and then it zaps Spock. And we get the reveal that, you know, this creature basically used Cyborg's desire for this thing. He wanted it so bad that this creature was able to use it and twist it, which is another cool idea, which really isn't given that much resonance, but it's a nice idea that Cyborg was exploited by this creature because of his deep desire to find this ultimate truth, that he's easily exploitable. I thought, wow, what a great concept, right? But it's for nothing, really. Cyborg does he basically sacrifices himself to try to save the others, and he distracts the creature for a moment. He does the share me your pain. He dies. They get the transporters back online, so Spock and McCoy get beamed out, and of course, you know, Kirk's by himself now. You know, the Klingons are now attacking as well, and Spock gets the Klingon ambassador to kind of talk down the Klingon captain, but we don't see how that works out right away. This is the moment, I think, where Kirk was supposed to be being chased by rock monsters. Spock has a nice moment with Kord, the Klingon commander, where Spock says, you know, I'll need your expertise, you're his superior officer. And the guy's like, I'm just a foolish old man. And Spock goes, damn you, sir, you will try. Like, good line, you know? And then this is basically Kirk being chased by a giant head shooting lightning bolts out of its eyes, which is just stupid for an end of Trek movie. It's so dumb. And it's taken out by the Klingon ship, piloted by Kord, I believe, and Spock is the gunner. Give me a break. And they make the Klingon commander apologize, which is just goofy. There is one moment, you know, of course, then they want to cap off the theme. Kirk says, I thought I was a goner. Spock says, impossible, Captain, you were never alone. And then, you know, Kirk's about to hug him, and there's a funny line where Spock goes, please, Captain, not in front of the Klingons. It's like, okay, that's all right. Then we wrap it up on the Enterprise. You know, men like us don't have families. I was wrong. You know, we are family. And then we cut back to Yosemite again, and it's row, row your boat, and we're done. So brief summary about Five. I mean, it's a lark. It's a lark. The main problem here is there's never really much at stake. No one's in any real danger. You know, what's at stake really? Ever, right? I mean, he's going to take control of the Enterprise, but he's not going to like lay waste to a civilization or a galaxy. He's not going to kill anybody or destroy the Federation or start a war. He's going to zoom out to the center of the galaxy, which if he fails, okay, so he fails. You know, like, there's nothing at stake. And there's nothing personally at stake for either three characters. Like, maybe if one of them had a faith conflict within themselves that it could have been played out as a sub-theme, but no, there's nothing going on here. The notion of McCoy at that moment after he goes through that thing with Cyborg, that he's going to leave with Cyborg, and then he decides to stay because they're not going anywhere. I didn't like that. I feel like, you know, you don't, these three, I mean, he chooses not to go, but he was about to, you know, and I feel like I didn't like the fact that Bones was kind of brainwashed. Just, you know, was not a fan of that. But yeah, so I mean, the metaphor is interesting. That central sequence where Cyborg sort of psychoanalyzes them is really, I love it. I wish it would be a whole other movie. the metaphor of getting past a great barrier to see something maybe more spiritual versus pain, right? Really cool. I like that. But, you know, they throw it away with a lame twist ending. So this is really a nothing movie. Having seen it now for this podcast, I doubt I will ever watch it again unless I do some crazy marathon with somebody. A little bit of trivia. The Enterprise D corridor sets from Next Gen were used as the corridors in this film, and very few cosmetic alterations were made, so not to interfere with the filming of Next Gen, which was going on at the time. According to George Takei, he originally turned down the film because he didn't want to be directed by Shatner, with whom he had had a long-standing feud. But Shatner personally convinced Takei to reprise the role, and later Takei said that Shatner was quite the gentleman as a director. This is kind of funny. During a pre-production meeting, the screenwriter, David Lowery, jokingly proposed to have Uhura appear as an erotic dancer in order to lure away the hostage takers from the compound, and was shocked and dismayed to learn that the producers approved of the idea right away. I thought that's the movie, pretty much. I mean, that pretty much is Star Trek V right there. Like I was mentioning earlier, the film contains the first confirmed appearance of Starfleet Marines, an idea Roddenberry wanted but was unable to do in the first, you know, original series, probably through budget constraints. So according to the text commentary on the DVD, Sulu and Chekhov were supposed to be seen hiking at Mount Rushmore. Originally, there was supposed to be a tracking shot going up to reveal the president's faces on a matte painting, and that the painting would feature an African-American female president next to the other four. But the budget constraints did not allow that to happen, so they scrapped it. And again, Shakari was a play on Sean Connery's name, who they did not get to play Cybok. And Nichelle Nichols, who was an accomplished singer and dancer, I believe she has one album out. She did do the fan dance routine. That was her. But she was outraged when her vocals in the scene were overdubbed without her approval. So that's about all I have to say about Star Trek V, The Final Frontier.
Thanks once again for listening to Sci-Fi on Screen to my returning listeners and new listeners alike. If you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions about the show, you can send an email to scifionscreen@gmail.com, or feel free to leave a comment on the website www.scifionscreen.com, and you can leave a comment in the comments section of the show page. If you'd like to support scifionscreen.com, you can go to patreon.com/scifionscreen, and that's Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And to make it easy on yourself, there is a button on the webpage that you can click. Patreon is set up so you can pick an amount you want to contribute per episode, and it'll be recurring. If you'd like to do that, that is available. We'd appreciate all the support we can get. And you can find us, again, our website, www.scifionscreen.com. We have a Facebook page, and on any smartphone, you can search for us on the podcast app and subscribe. Thanks again. See you next time.